From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Well, well, well. Isn't this where we came in?
Iran continues to thumb its nose at the United Nations demand.
The deadline that's been given to Iran over their nuclear plans.
That's important. Did Iran's answer on its, to the UN on its nuclear
Iran
program?
Said it would give an answer tomorrow, but it may have come one day early.
The drumbeat to intervention in Iran sounds very familiar, almost as if we'd seen this picture before. The international standoff about the country's nuclear program has led to increasing fear and suspicion of Iran's intentions. In a particularly eerie reprise of the build-up to war in Iraq, a Republican-authored House report excoriates the U.S. intelligence apparatus for failing to be sufficiently ominous about the Iranian threat. The similarities are so striking, in fact, that a page one New York Times story on the report Thursday spent hundreds of words distancing itself from the House report's conclusions, an almost comic effort not to be accused of Judy Millerism. Meanwhile, like Iraq's Saddam Hussein 4 years ago, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad himself has done nothing to quell the West's worst fears. On the contrary, he is increasingly defiant to the outside world and apparently increasingly repressive internally. Last week, according to reports, the Iranian government ordered a crackdown on the satellite dishes with which Iranians view foreign programming, from news to entertainment to anti-government agitation from the U.S.-based Persian diaspora. This conjures images of the Cold War, when those trapped behind the Iron Curtain had to illicitly monitor Radio Free Europe or the BBC for just a glimpse at the outside world. But Time magazine Tehran correspondent Ajadeh Moveni says the picture is far more nuanced than that.
Well, crackdown on satellite dishes are a periodic occurrence here, to be honest. It's not something that's new. Usually, these kind of raids coincide with either a period of wanting to clamp down on the kind of news Iranians get from the outside world or some other domestic reason why there's revival of such hardline policies.
How difficult is it in Iran to get Western news?
It's pretty accessible. Middle-class families, by and large, have satellite dishes. They're not terribly expensive. So television that is beamed in from the West, whether it's Western channels or Iranian satellite channels beamed in from Los Angeles, are very popular. Radio is also a very popular way for Iranians to get their news. Channels like VOA and BBC Persian. Internet access is common, it's widespread, and so people are connecting with the outside world and hear news from the outside and are not only relying on this sort of diet of state-controlled media for their context for news and what's happening in the world.
In your last piece in Time, you talked about the central fear of the ruling clergy about opening up towards the West, not of some sort of military takeover, but of actually the seduction of the Iranian people by Western values, Western money, Western influences in general.
The perception here by the government is that it would be opening up a Pandora's box, because since its inception, this revolution has been conceived, entrenched by anti-Westernism. So I think the fear is that perhaps it wouldn't radically alter things in the short term, in the 2 or 3, 5 year horizon, but 20 years, 15 years down the line, you know, what will be the result of opening up?
Officialdom in Iran is split between the clergy, who are the supreme leaders, and the government, at the moment run by President Ahmadinejad, who himself is extremely conservative. Is the populace of Iran, though, as conservative as right now both the government and the clergy?
Not at all. I think that really the government, whether it's the clergy or the elected government run by the president, is far more conservative and traditional, religiously speaking, than the masses of Iranian society. I think that realistically they represent maybe something between 15 to 20-25% at most of Iranians. I think the majority are much more secular in their political viewpoints, much more worldly, much more at home with Western culture than what the government reflects. And I think you see that every day very vividly in the streets of Tehran when you see how women dress, when you see what kind of shops open, mimicking shops in the West. It's really a society that is very much ahead of its leaders.
So how is this reflected in the current standoff over Iran's nuclear capabilities? What are the local media saying about the situation? Is it sympathetic to the government? Is it nationalistic? Is it in any way dissident? Is it even uniform?
Well, in recent months, since this nuclear conflict has deepened, the coverage of it has become more and more constricted. In the domestic press here, no, the critics of the government's nuclear policy don't really come forward to express themselves very openly. It doesn't seem like there's very much official tolerance for a freewheeling, very honest debate about the future of the nuclear program. And so, no, I think when it comes to that, it's debated within the parameters that the government has set up.
So as you speak to ordinary Iranians, how do they process the gulf between the fairly constricted media reporting that you describe and what is freely available from the West through satellites, through the internet, and so forth?
The discord is something that Iranians are very used to. You know, media is state-controlled here. It very much reflects the government's viewpoint, and it has for years and years. And that has become ordinary to Iranians. I think that's why, also, Iranians include such a variety of different media into their news diet. You know, the average person might go to 3 or 4 different sources to find out what happened on a given day over any issue. If you go to the newsstand in the morning, you'll sort of see there are 20, 30 papers.
And finally, the flip side of the question, when you first went to Tehran, did you find that Americans have the right images of what life is like there?
No, I was shocked because I felt as though the American conception of Iran was still locked in the not without my daughter sort of conception and those kind of attitudes, which are so dated. I mean, Americans would be surprised to find that ordinary life for middle-class people in cities is really not unlike what their own lives are like.
Ajadeh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ajadeh Mulvaney is a reporter for Time magazine. She spoke to us from Tehran. While there are plenty of foreign journalists based in Iran, the U.S. State Department has granted visas to only 2 reporters from the Iranian state media. We spoke to one of them, Maqsood Amirian, about the restrictions he works under, restrictions placed on him not by his own government, but by ours. He doesn't speak English, so we spoke to him via an interpreter. Maqsood, welcome to On the Media.
It's my pleasure.
For foreign correspondents the world over, New York is a pretty plum posting. When you got the assignment, what was your reaction?
Normally, because we follow the news of our colleagues as much as possible and hear about all the limitations from our friends, naturally you would worry a little bit. And you lose interest in coming to New York.
And what are some of those limitations? I understand, for one thing, you cannot travel beyond a radius of 25 miles from Midtown Manhattan.
In order to come to America, or better yet, to New York, we need to go through a long procedure to obtain a visa. When we finally succeed in getting this visa, we encounter a type of visa which is called C2. This type of visa is particular to flight attendants, and as you know well, it would deprive us from the right that regular foreign residents have. The truth is, it's not possible for us to obtain a driver's license with this kind of visa. And again, as a reporter, it's not even feasible to take pictures in the streets. When we are speaking of 25 miles limitations, we have to accept this limitation that the U.S. government imposes upon us, whether good or bad.
Is this because you are presumed, as an employee of the state news agency, presumed by the U.S. government to be a spy for Iran?
This we have to ask the American government, whether they have this view of me or people like me. I really don't know.
The official view of the United States back in Iran is of the great Satan. Are you obliged to file only stories that portray America that way? Or can you share some of America's greatness, like, I don't know, democracy and frozen pizza, HBO?
First of all, I was limited to my 25 miles, if not less, so I did not have the chance to go and see things like frozen pizza. And we have so much work that it does not allow us the time for things like that. But on the subject of democracy and freedom, I really need to feel freedom for myself. I feel like I have entered a place where they have created a 25-mile prison for me. I have not seen my family for 14 months, including two of my children. They do not issue them a visa to see me. I am caught here with a type of visa that allows me only one entry and one exit. I cannot even use my vacation time. So again, I need to feel democracy for myself. How can I report things that I have not seen here?
You are obviously under very onerous restrictions here, but if you were free to travel, what kind of stories would you want to cover?
In that case, I would write about the good things. But right now, I am not seeing much of good things.
Are you followed by FBI agents?
Even if they are after me, I wouldn't pay any attention to them. But I would be happy to have a companion.
Maksud, thanks very much. Maksud Amirian is a reporter for the Iranian state news agency IRNA, based in New York. Our translator was Amir Vahab. Coming up, child porn and the posthumous appeal of JonBenet Ramsey. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. If you ask me, the Internet is the most significant technological development since man first used fire. It is transforming society in innumerable ways, but like fire, it can be violently and tragically abused to help terrorism, for instance, or to propagate hate or enable child pornographers and sexual predators. In his two-part New York Times series Dark Corners this week, reporter Kurt Eichenwald offers a glimpse into the world of so-called child love chat rooms, where pedophiles have coalesced to form a sort of social movement, one constantly seeking ways to facilitate and justify fantasy and real-life sex with minors. He exposes, for instance, the evolution of so-called modeling sites, which try to evade the law by clothing their subjects in skimpy garments and posing them provocatively. An editor's note reminded readers that it's a crime to view child porn and informed them that the Times, quote, complied with the law, disclosing what it found to appropriate authorities. It wasn't the first time Eichenwald had run up against the journalistic mantras of not involving law enforcement and not getting involved in your story. Last year, during the reporting of a long piece about child webcam pornography, he convinced his primary source, Justin Berry, to turn federal witness and to assist in a massive government crackdown. It raised the eyebrows of some media watchdogs, but Eichenwald insists that the moral choice was clear.
I do not believe that we as journalists, simply to satisfy each other, have some ethical obligation to be inhuman. I do not believe that if a congressional reporter walks into an office and sees a congressman raping his secretary on the desk, that the only thing he can do is take out his notepad and write down the details.
One of the arguments that have been put forward, chiefly by Jack Schaefer of Slate, is the slippery slope argument that your arrangement with Justin in this story and with law enforcement changes the expectations for all journalists in the future in their handling sources in these very sketchy areas, that the next source may expect for the reporter to somehow broker his relationship with law enforcement, or that the source may fear that you're, in essence, a spy for law enforcement and putting future journalists at risk.
Now, what I thought the criticism was going to be was that I left 14 kids out there. There were 15 kids who did interviews with me who were wrapped up in child pornography. 14 of them said, I know what I'm doing and I'm safe and don't worry about it. Didn't go on the record, didn't authorize me to do anything other than utilize their information. One of them got out of the business, and when I realized that he was aware of children being raped, I convinced him to go to the government. But it wasn't much of an effort. It took about a minute and a half. I don't see how that creates any form of a slippery slope. If a source comes to you and says, there's a woman being murdered in the apartment down the street, well, yes, I do think that a reporter should say, you should go call the cops.
So if there's no Jack Schaefer rule governing the relationship between a reporter and the source.
Well, let's not pick on Jack.
But what rules should govern those relationships when clearly in order to get the story, they have to go beyond the very formal constraints of source-reporter relationship?
Our question here is, what are we? Are we a bureaucracy or are we a news-gathering organization? You know, bureaucracies are concerned about rules for the sake of the rules. I believe a news-gathering organization, we don't actually even have rules. Really, we are working off of guiding principles in how do we protect the journalism as opposed to how do we, you know, kneel at the altar of certain rules that may or may not apply in this circumstance, but that some people invoke as absolute and other people ignore completely?
When you encounter children who are in clear and present danger, what's your to-do list? Is it tell my editors, call the cops, write the story? How does it work?
It depends. There have only been a few instances of that. There was one instance in the course of the past year where I became very concerned because there was a pedophile who was online seeking advice on how he could transform his physical relationship with a 7-year-old girl into a sexual relationship. And it was very clear that he was intending to do something about this in the next few days. It was an event that was going to happen, not something that had happened. In that circumstance, I called my editors and said, I need to report this to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And I was given authorization. I reported it to the National Center. They checked it, and then they made a criminal referral. And as I understand it, the person was arrested.
Because this stuff is so horrifying, And because you are always at risk of breaking the law yourself when you're coming across the material, how does law enforcement get involved here? And what was your relationship with it?
The law is very clear. It is illegal to download, it is illegal to save, and it is illegal to view child pornography. Now, there is a safe harbor under the law, and that safe harbor is if you've gone someplace, you get there, you didn't know what you were getting, and you are in a child porn site, if you immediately report it, delete your cache files, and delete any other related files that may have come from the website, you can be deemed as having been somebody who is innocently coming across these things. Now, I found the model sites because I clicked on a link that was posted in one of the conversations. I didn't know where I was going to. The first site I went to was fine. I clicked on something from there, and it took me into the bowels of hell. I am required by law to notify law enforcement of the sites I found. That's all I'm required to do. I'm not going to give them my notes. I'm not going to give them sources. I just have to say, if you go to www.this.com, it's a child porn site. Had I not done that, had I said, well, I'm a journalist and therefore the law doesn't apply to me, I could be arrested.
The bowels of hell. I want to ask you about your personal journey into the bowels of hell. It's clear how you feel about the child victims of pornography. I'm wondering what you think about the pedophiles themselves.
You know, on some level, for some of them, and this might surprise people because I do seem to have, when you hear me, it sounds like I have hatred. Many of them, I feel sorry for them. Nobody would choose to isolate themselves in this way. And there are those who recognize that their desires are, in fact, damaging to children. And so they make sure they stay away from kids. And I actually have respect for those people. For those who rationalize it, for those who sit there and say, you know, children benefit from sexual relations with adults, for those who say that they're fighting for children's rights to have sex with adults, I have nothing but contempt for them. You know, I have seen more kids sobbing in front of me. I have had more instances of witnessing an image that haunts me for months. This is the first time in my life that I've needed to go into counseling sponsored by, you know, the Times, where I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I had to stop doing this for 3 months. You know, my wife periodically will say, you know, are you sure you can keep handling this? I'm not sure. But there is nothing more important in this country in terms of transforming the social fabric of our nation than the internet. And reporters are duty-bound to let readers understand how it is transforming us, both for good and for bad. And if we ignore the bad, then we, I believe, are abdicating any right we have to say that we are journalists.
All right, Kurt. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kurt Eichenwald is a business reporter for The New York Times. The timing of Eichenwald's stories was disturbingly serendipitous, appearing on the heels of an arrest in the JonBenet Ramsey case. After 10 years, a confession in the murder of the 6-year-old girl has put the horrors of child sexual abuse and child sexualization front and center. Those pictures that had been a weekly staple of People magazine and the supermarket tabloids are back with a vengeance, and one in particular. JonBenet at a kid's beauty pageant, tricked up like a showgirl. Those images and the lurid memories of the brutal crime once again stopped the media in its tracks, as noted wryly by Jon Stewart.
Let me explain something to you about the algebra, if you will, of cable news. 3-year war in Iraq is less than a 30-day-old bombing of Lebanon, which is less than explosive Gatorade on a plane, all of which is apparently chicken next to break in the 10-year-old murder case. Yes, apparently a suspect has been named in the case of the killing of JonBenet Ramsey, or as she is known to cable news, Oxygen.
So what is it about JonBenet that a decade after her murder so commands media attention? Is it the grotesquerie of the pageant photos? Is it the fear her killing engenders in parents? James Kincaid, a professor of English at the University of Southern California, wrote a column for Slate this week in which he claimed that it's actually neither. He joins us now to explain. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
There's a lot to be made queasy over, but one thing that got under your skin in the latest chapter of the JonBenet Ramsey story was the media coverage itself. Why does it upset you?
Well, it upsets me only insofar as the media coverage reflects what our culture seems to want and need. For instance, it allows us to make all kinds of very suspicious dichotomies between tabloid and cable news and so-called legitimate news, so that the Washington Post, New York Times, NPR can duck under the radar by claiming this is really other people who are interested, not really us, as if the media were thrusting on us material that we had no interest in otherwise. This is pretty obvious scapegoating to be able to satisfy our own interests while we're at the same time disowning them.
What part of a 10-year-old murder mystery, which suddenly out of nowhere yields not only a suspect, but someone confessing to the crime, improperly gets our attention?
I don't know that it's improper. It's exactly the same mechanism we use with, say, Catholic priests who keep coming up, or Michael Jackson does the same thing, hauling back to the surface yet one more reason so we can talk about kids and sex, and to self-righteously claim that it's somebody else really interested in this image of JonBenet strutting down the runway.
So what you're saying is that humans have this deep-seated need to think about issues of children and sexuality, but only have the cover to do it when there's a crime or a scandal afoot, and then they can, you know, discuss it openly in the media and over the water cooler and at the dinner table and so forth.
I don't think it's a deep-seated natural need to find kids sexy. I think it's a cultural phenomenon of the last 200 years, though, to more and more eroticize children. And you look at something like the Calvin Klein ads and wonder what motivates the way in which youthful bodies are imaged there in order to sell a product, or the use of kids in television sitcoms and movies and the like. I mentioned in the article the case of Shirley Temple and Graham Greene's specifying the fantasy she played to. I'm not accusing everyone of being a pedophile, just of mixing up that which is alluring to us with ever younger images. This is not quite the same thing as saying that everyone's lusting after JonBenet. Other things are at work here. JonBenet also allows us to make distinctions between good parents and bad parents, aligning ourselves, of course, with the good parents who would never do such a thing. But even good parents are putting kids on display all the time.
Well, it's a provocative point, but I'm just curious, what evidence do you have that there's any kind of relationship between the parading of children out of pride or just a native cuteness and parading them as somehow as sexual beings? That connection utterly escapes me.
The evidence has to do with historically the way the idea of innocence became attached to children. At the same time, it became attached to unmarried women as a kind of lure in the marriage market. You know, looking inside your own response is not likely to show you anything. Naturally, nobody is going to say, or mighty few people are going to say, yeah, I find myself attracted to children. But there are things like, as I cite in my books, all kinds of studies of, oh, say, facial features, which are done by computer graphics, which show the typical profile of 10, 14, 18, 25-year-olds. And they ask people with these images, which are the most alluring to you? And over again, the good news is that 8-year-olds don't come out at number one. The bad news is that it's about 14, which suggests that our cultural ideals are unthinkable and, in fact, illegal.
Well, I think there's two things at work here. First, there's the tendency to pay more attention to a story once there is a narrative attached to it, and it has a human face. And then there's also the category of personifying a parent's worst fears. Certainly someone like JonBenet Ramsey does that, does she not?
Well, parents' worst fears, if they're displacing the actual problems that kids face onto something that makes them very comfortable. The idea that what parents have to worry about are strangers is a classic displacement of a real concern. We are relatively indifferent to massive problems concerning, say, emotional and physical abuse of children, and go after a specific area of sexual abuse tied to strangers. Most abuse occurs within the family. It's the fox guarding the hen house. And it doesn't come from predators on the net or abduction and things like that. So to stop at saying, yes, isn't it ghastly what happened to JonBenet? Of course it is. Of course it is. It's just that we always do stop there. And there's a reason we do.
All right, Jim. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Kincaid is a professor of English at the University of Southern California. He is author of Erotic Innocence, The Culture of Child Molesting. Now for a few of your letters. The piece that ended last week's show was one of mine from a few years back about movie blurbs. In it, a reviewer named Andrew Johnston, then of Us Weekly, said that reviewers in small market media will say anything to get their names onto ads. Sheila Abrams of Schoolies Mountain, New Jersey, took offense. She writes, "As a longtime arts writer and editor for local weekly papers, I can say that it ain't necessarily so. Maybe since my outlets are so small, nobody cares enough to offer me bribes, but it wouldn't work if they did, because I care what my readers think of my judgment." And finally, Amelia Heath, Ross Day, Reed Vanderberg, Peter Gunn, Pete Wells, Tom Heckler, Jay Lister, Dan Cahoon, Justin Henderson, and David Tellickson all sent emails to chastise me for saying Willamette, when of course I should have said Willamette in the great state of Oregon. Just kidding. Oregon. I know. It's Oregon. Oregon. I know. And keep those emails from Oregon and everywhere else coming in to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And please don't forget to tell us where in Oregon you live and how to pronounce your name. Coming up, some math. What do you get when you take financial records, subtract humans, and add a computer program? Is it journalism? This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. On this program, we have occasionally looked into the reporting of finance, polling, statistics, and other math-heavy stories to see if journalists have sufficient mastery to accurately explain their subject matter. But according to Gene Epstein, economics editor for Barron's, there's a more sinister problem still. Journalists and pundits who twist numbers to make a point. He calls the practice econo-spinning, and he joins us now. Gene, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
One of the topics you homed in on was the bestseller Freakonomics by Stephen Levitt and the journalist Stephen Dubner.
Yeah.
A runaway bestseller, mm-hmm. and the premise of the book was to use economic principles to itself debunk some conventional wisdom on any number of things, one of the most controversial of which was decreases in the crime rate. Levitt had maintained that the reason for the dramatic dip in crime over the 90s was due to legalized abortion. You say that he missed something very obvious.
Yes. What he missed is that if legalized abortion had something to do with the plummeting crime rate in the 90s, then it must have affected the crime rate in the 90s by causing a decline in births in the crime-prone population in the early 70s. But what he did not look at was births. And so if you just look up the birth figures, you find there was no decline in births as a share of the population going into the 90s. So even if they had more abortions, it doesn't necessarily mean that they had fewer babies. And because it was kind of a sexy, interesting, provocative finding, it was generally accepted by his vast readership.
After maybe the interest rates set by the Federal Reserve, probably the most followed number in Washington is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics every month on the employment rates. And it's fairly complex economic information boiled down into a couple of numbers. And you write about how the press so hangs on these numbers that they report apparent increases and decreases even if they don't exist. Tell me about statistical significance, please. Yes.
Statistical significance, right. Well, merely because the number changed, it doesn't necessarily mean that the thing itself changed. For example, any time the unemployment rate moves by a tenth of a percentage point, say from 4.7% to 4.8%, that's a change that is so small, there's no way to tell whether there really was a change.
We're going to be seeing a lot of this in the political races, poll results that say so-and-so has a 3-point lead with a 5% margin of error.
That's right.
Which is incorrect because nobody knows who's ahead because the margin of error exceeds the apparent difference in their percentages.
When the Bureau of Labor Statistics publishes a number like 4.6 and 4.7, the media will take it literally. The commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, at a public forum with a bunch of newspaper reporters, complained that they trying to squeeze the sizzle out of everything the BLS reports. And the response she got from a very prominent journalist was that he had no choice. He had to report the number because he could not explain to his readers statistical insignificance. The problem with doing that is that there's no sizzle in it.
That's a good example of a general problem and one that listeners, readers, and viewers can look for as they read about economic coverage. But you devote most of your book to taking on individual targets, notably Paul Krugman of the New York Times, for his citation of certain unemployment statistics that you say he is taking out of context and incorrectly conflating. Mm. Let's just say you have thoroughly debunked Paul Krugman on this. What larger lesson is there for us to learn?
The larger lesson to learn is that it's very unlikely that if you read the chapters in which I talk about the unemployment rate, long-term unemployment, about discouraged workers, the labor force participation rate, all of them concepts related to the unemployment rate, and all of them concepts that Krugman misinterpreted. What you would come away with is not just an understanding that our most important economic journalist, because of his position at the New York Times, continually misinterprets such numbers, but what you'd also come away with is an enhanced ability to understand what these numbers are all about.
Did you have a larger mission here?
I don't think I had a larger mission in the sense of its being, let's say, ideological. But I also take on the Wall Street Journal, the cash cow that is part of my own employer, Dow Jones, for its own econo-spinning. And I certainly did not want to give any aid and comfort to any particular position on the conventional political spectrum.
Let me ask you one more thing.
Okay.
I have this image of you.
Yes.
Sitting there reading Paul Krugman's column, you know, and watching Lou Dobbs and reading this mammoth bestseller, Freakonomics, and just seething and seething and saying to yourself, all right, I know I was going to write this primer on how to really honestly broker statistical information and other data, but no, I've got to destroy these men. Am I warm on that one?
I'm afraid you're not. I do feel passionate about the issues. However, the problem that I had with respect to writing a primer about economic data is that it would be too dry. And as a result, people wouldn't read it. Now, I then realized, however, that Lou Dobbs, Krugman, and others actually have used this data to deal with subjects that matter. The effect of foreigners on the labor markets in the case of Dobbs. In the case of Levitt, perhaps the most important issue of all, the plummeting crime rate. Do we want to believe in findings that make no sense? Because if we do, we might not have a sufficient understanding about policies that can continue to bring about the plummeting crime rate. So I found the opportunity to both teach people about the use of economic data while at the same time dealing with issues that mattered.
All right. Well, Gene, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gene Epstein is the economics editor of Barron's and author of Econospinning, How to Read Between the Lines When the Media Manipulate the Numbers. We asked Paul Krugman of the New York Times to respond to Epstein's charges that he irresponsibly mixed apples with oranges, and this is what Krugman wrote, quote, "He apparently thinks he can read my mind. He claims that I mixed data from two surveys to write an article about job growth, even though data from only one survey appeared in the article. I used only the one survey that I cited. Please let your listeners know that I am happy to acknowledge errors that I actually make, but not those that are figments of a critic's imagination." Well, there's one way to remove human error from financial reporting. Remove the human altogether. A financial news service has begun using computer software to analyze corporate earnings statements and robotically write the stories in a fraction of a second. Andrew Marr is the director of content development for Thomson Financial, and he joins us now. Andrew, welcome to OTM.
Thanks, Bob.
Describe for me how these computer-generated stories work.
What we've done is taken the data that we have sitting in the numerous databases that Thomson owns and run them through a set of processes which are based on business rules and various algorithms that ends up creating free text that actually would appear to be the same as anything that's been written by a person.
Okay, now frequently a quarterly report will include not only the numbers on earnings per share and so forth, but there'll be footnoted items which would really change the entire context for all of the ordinary earnings figures. How does the computer deal with footnotes?
What we do there, and it's actually the entire process in collecting estimates from analysts, is that if we come up with something which is a significant anomaly from the expectation, we go back and we ask the analysts to make sure that they're comparing like for like with the way the company's reporting. So we have a flag that stops the story going out until we get that reconciliation. And in that instance, you know, there's still a role for the journalist because a computer can't do that.
So the computer can't be spun in the way that a human reporter can?
No.
Now, I must say that if this were morning television or something like that, every anchor would ask the following question. Tell me, Andrew, is my job in jeopardy? But let me ask you something, Andrew. Is my job in jeopardy?
If you believe that the height of your skill set is to take a set of numbers from a financial database and put it into a template, then yes, it is.
All right, Andrew, well, thank you so much.
A pleasure. Thanks very much for your time.
Andrew Marr is the Director of Content Development for Thomson Financial. We should note, however, that robotically turning out Wall Street stories is nothing new. It's been going on forever, not using computer software, but regular human reporters. As we reported back in 2003, they somehow can absorb all the activity that takes place in all the financial markets on any given day and knock out a story miraculously reducing it all to its absolute essence.
This is the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Amid the hustle and bustle on Wednesday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 87 points, or just under 1% of its value. The NASDAQ was off 100 points. Why? CNBC seemed to know.
Welcome back. A busy news day. The market's moving a little bit lower today. A word of a new tape from Osama bin Laden causing the markets to sort of fall off the table there.
Got that? Over a period of 6.5 hours, millions of investors traded billions of shares of stock because of word of a new tape from Osama bin Laden. The day before, both the Dow and the NASDAQ were down because, according to the Associated Press, of a disappointing revenue outlook for Nokia and investor profit-taking. The day before that, according to USAtoday.com, the Dow was up 83 points due to optimism about the economy. Really?
That's as reasonable as anything.
Ray Goldbacher is the money editor at USAtoday.com.
You know, every day, 3 billion shares change hands. Who knows why? I mean, the best you can do is try to take the temperature of the predominant trend. Analysts and journalists find ways to explain the market no matter what it does, or try.
They do try. Every trading day, reporters at the Associated Press, Bloomberg, Reuters, USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, and a dozen other news organizations are expected to distill millions of discrete financial decisions and divine a single motivating factor. Some days it's a Commerce Department report on business inventories. Sometimes it's a jump in IBM's earnings. Sometimes it's the mysterious technical factors. Or dropping oil prices, or terrorism jitters, or investor optimism, or the magical, all-encompassing profit-taking. Dan Gross covers Wall Street for Slate.com.
Of course, there's profit-taking every single minute of every single day. It's a very convenient shorthand for, we don't know why the Dow went down 70 points.
But, Gross says, his colleagues do know how to find someone to float a theory.
You have a number of sources, guys you know you can call for a quote, and the guys on the other end have a limited number of things that they will say. It was down on profit-taking, up on optimism, concern about profits. You know, there are a set number of factors that everybody will say.
One source often turned to for the daily analysis is Hugh Johnson, chairman of asset management for the investment banking house First Albany Corporation. With his more than 3 decades of market experience, Johnson carefully considers corporate fundamentals, external news events, trading patterns, known as technicals, the push and pull of other markets, such as commodities, bonds, and currency trading, and his long-cultivated instinct for the psychology of the trading floor. And then he guesses.
It's a real giant leap of faith to say this is what's been on the minds of investors and made them make decisions, because you obviously don't survey every investor. But you get a sense that the markets tend to respond or react to news in a fairly predictable way. Having done this for a while, it's probably a pretty good guess that these events do in somehow, some manner, affect investors.
Or, you know, not. We are in the Irish Punt Saloon, a favorite hangout for brokers and traders, shortly after the closing bell on a sultry summer afternoon. We approach a young Wall Streeter named Anthony Piacosta.
I need your expert analysis. NASDAQ was down 21 points today, a little over 1%. Why?
There's a few reasons, actually. One of the reasons was that Cisco came out with earnings and their expectations were as great as said to be, and Cisco is pretty much one of the largest of the NASDAQ composite, so pulls down the average very easily.
Quick follow-up question. Are you sure?
Am I sure? Positive.
Then we collar his pal, Dieter Huber.
NASDAQ was down about 1% today. Why?
The NASDAQ's down now because technicals have taken over. It's like 1675, 1690 we're sitting at. Once it broke that level, now technicals on the NASDAQ are actually taking over, and the traders will just fight to sell because they're up.
You sure about that?
Yes. As for the NASDAQ being down today, it's because of technicals.
Then finally we turn to their colleague, Kieran Lockhearn, who crunches the same numbers on NASDAQ's dip, and draws an entirely different and stunning conclusion.
It's probably just overheated, you know? Numbers have come out. There's nothing to take us up any further. Now people eventually look at the profits that they have and realize either take them or get off the pot.
So a little bit of profit taking.
Yeah, sure.
Ah, profit taking. But if single-factor analysis sometimes seems silly or worse, at least one Wall Street watcher staunchly defends the practice. He is David Wilson, managing editor for Global Stock Markets at Bloomberg News, the organization that revolutionized financial journalism with up-to-the-second reports delivered to your desktop. Wilson insists that trading days do follow miniature trends and themes, with certain critical events assuming disproportionate influence.
There are days when it's pretty straightforward. You get a figure, you know, it might be a company earnings, it might be an economic report, and that really does set the tone for the day. And you see it even before trading begins, because you're looking at what's happening overseas with the futures markets, with U.S. stocks traded there. And it may be that whatever the theme is at 8:30 in the morning carries all the way through the day.
Hence, on Wednesday, according to Bloomberg as well as CNBC, what really mattered was the latest video from Osama bin Laden. Or, you know, not.
I'm very suspicious of anybody who looks at a market monolithically.
Lou Dobbs of CNN's nightly Lou Dobbs Tonight is among the most influential financial journalists in the world. He rolls his eyes at the simplistic art of the Wall Street market rap, but he also acknowledges his occasional complicity because of the time constraints of broadcast television and, he says, the demands of the audience.
There's not enough space in newspapers. There's not enough time on television or radio to give the explanation that it's deserved. And frankly, the audience wouldn't want it anyway, in most cases, the broader audience, because it is complex and it takes far too much time. So we revert to traditional shorthand that, while wrong, is expedient.
What if the press covered Congress the way it covers the street?
They do.
Well, not really. Although you can certainly say this. This week, the House and the Senate blocked a proposed Commerce Department rule that would have limited overtime pay for millions of workers on concerns about profit-taking. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Fuolo, and edited this week pretty much by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Noah Kuman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will really be back next week. This time I mean it. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by Ciao Bella Gelato, purveyors of all natural gelato and fruit sorbets. Their gelato is handmade with imported Italian ingredients. More at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. And thanks.